So, good morning and welcome to today's Employment Law 101 session. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We are in the south of England, but we work with businesses that are all over the world. They have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's how we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning.
Just a couple of housekeeping matters before we get into the meat of today's session. It is being recorded, so as always, you can pick up the session on our website if you want to look at the Zoom video recording, or you can listen to the audio on Spotify. You just need to search for Employment Law 101 to find that. I expect there might be a few questions arising out of today's topic as well. Can you hear me okay, by the way? Because I think my volume's a little bit low
You've
today.
just gone very quiet, actually.
I'll try and shout a little bit louder. Today, topic may well generate quite a few questions. So if you would like to ask questions, we absolutely welcome them. Please use the Q&A function, which is down at the bottom of your screen to ask questions. If you want to chat to other participants, you can do that using the chat function. But for questions, please use the Q&A for those of you that are live with us today. So, what are we talking about today? Well, it's all about return to office mandates and resultant pitfalls. Now, it's definitely true. I think the background noise is getting louder on all of this, both in terms of the press and certainly in our day-to-day practice as employment lawyers. It's all about how to get employees back to an office environment. Now, whether that's due to suspicion about employees just putting their feet up at home, or because there's a drive to support the local sandwich and cafe economy, there are many, many reasons, and there are a lot of varying views over what's happening. Here's an example scenario that we normally see, though. So the current work pattern might be office working for 2 days a week, with the rest of the time spent at home. The employer comes along and says, actually, we'd like everybody back into the office 4 days a week out of five, if we're talking about full-time workers here. Where does this lead to? Well, uproar, quite frankly. People have moved away from their normal work location. They've arranged their lives around the work from home model. Childcare might be set up a certain way, other commitments set up a certain way, people's personal interests. And to change it is all of a sudden a huge change. And so, because of that, we're seeing people submitting more flexible working requests to try and circumvent the requirement to be back into a physical office environment. Now, a recent case looked at this, or partly looked at this issue in respect to flexible working. And that's what we want to talk about today, isn't it, Adrienne?
Yeah, this is me being particularly sad. So generally what happens is when I see a case that's reported in the press, I sometimes get a little bit cross about the clickbait in the headlines, and then sadly I go onto the employment decisions website on gov.uk to read actually what happens. And this is exactly what happened in a recent employment tribunal case. Now I'll say up front to start with, it is only employment tribunal, which legally means that it's not a binding decision. Because it hasn't gone up through the appeal courts. But I just thought it would be really interesting to kind of talk through the case and see what we can get out of it, really. So, look, in brief, the facts of the case were the claimant was on maternity leave and then applied for flexible working for when she returned. And before that, she was fully office-based and worked full-time. Her application was refused, as was her appeal, and she returned to work and then she resigned. Now, all of that seems, fairly similar to maternity leave returning that we've always had in the past. But in terms of her claims, she claimed that her employer failed to deal with her flexible working request in line with the statutory procedure. Their requirement was that she had to come back from to the office and couldn't work partly from home, and she said that was also indirect sex discrimination, which we'll talk a bit about. She suffered various events which she said were unfavorable treatment due to pregnancy and maternity leave, and I'm probably not going to cover that because it's not sort of on topic for today. But also the way that that the employer handled her grievance, the flexible working request, and how the return to work was handled ultimately led to her resigning and also going for constructive dismissal. So we've got the full gamut of claims in this one particular one, which is why it was quite an interesting one to read. But let's have a look at the flexible working request first. Now, as is often the case, she had an informal discussion with her manager, and what she asked for was actually not just a request for her, but a request for her and her whole team to work from home 1 or 2 days a week. She also wanted to adjust her working hours to start an hour earlier, finish 2 hours earlier, and then she would make up the remaining hours by doing an hour each evening after her baby had gone to bed. And that's quite a common request. Now, the first thing that the employer did was tell her that she needed to fill out a formal flexible working form, which, according to the tribunal, this disappointed the claimant. But as it was, the formal request that she submitted was really different. This time, she wanted to work up to 3 days from home with that additional evening working in the amendment to working hours. But she said in her request that she would, of course, be flexible if there were specific meetings that she needed to attend. And in that request, she set out some reasons as to why she thought it would work. So all good stuff. The claimant said that a lot of her role could be done anywhere, as it was email-based in terms of what she was doing, or it was Skype-based, for that read Zoom, Teams, Google Meet, whatever. The tribunal accepted this, but also recognised, and this is a good bit for employers to think about, is that the tribunal did recognise that it was important that some of the time they could understand why it was important that physically she was in the office to meet with colleagues. So that was that part. As with many of the flexible requests that we see, she used the COVID pandemic and one other occasion, which had happened in her own history at work, where she worked remotely. She'd done absolutely fine. There'd been no criticisms of her performance and, you know, all performance reviews were fine. I'm sure that will sound very familiar to many of you listening today.
Just on that, I mean, just want to jump in there and say that that definitely is a sort of familiar refrain, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we see in respect of what happened during the pandemic and that used as an example as to why practices can work. But I mean, do you think there's scope for employers to say, well, that was exceptional, that they were exceptional circumstances, and actually that doesn't necessarily mean we're firing on all cylinders if we're accommodating that particular way of working?
Yeah, absolutely, because that was all about survival, right? There was no choice in the matter. It was mandated by the government. It was work from home or don't work at all.
Never
and
at all.
You know, some businesses would have been gone, so there was no choice. So I mean, I think it's all down to sort of the factual matrix and being able to demonstrate, like you said, that the business wasn't firing on all cylinders, and maybe this is a point where you want to drive for growth or you want to drive for improvement. But that period of time was very much a, phew, we got through it, you know, rather than, yes, we did really, really well. And I think that's the kind of the nuances. But it is absolutely used in flexible working requests to demonstrate by an individual that, well, it was fine then. It worked absolutely fine then. What's the difference?
Mm.
And that's the critical question, is what is the difference in my view? So just coming back onto the case then, so what did the employer say? Well, they set up a meeting and she came in to talk to them. And this, I'm throwing this bit in because it just kind of gave me an indication of where the tribunal's head was at. She brought the baby in with her, and the employers attending the meeting were really critical that she'd done that. And in turn, the tribunal thought that it was ridiculous that they were critical of it and thought it was really a kind of indication of their mindset. But anyway, there we are. So anyway, to you, as all of you know, to reject a flexible working request, there are very specific statutory grounds that you've got to slot your reasoning into. I won't read them all out, but it includes things like detrimental impact on quality, detrimental impact on performance. So when they rejected her request, they gave six reasons, and I'm going to pick on a couple, which are the ones generally, again, that appear quite a lot in our flexible working requests that we see. The first is that remote working would inhibit the sharing of information that came with discussions and ad hoc conversations in the workplace. I think we probably call it water cooler mentality, and that ability just to sort of stick your head up above the desk and go, what about this? Another was that the maternity cover who'd been in place had attended on average five meetings a week. And the third one I'm picking up on is that they didn't want to set a precedent, which again is something else that comes up quite a lot in conversations. Now, I'm sure you all know that when you're looking at flexible working, the requirement now is to keep this as kind of open mindset And if the requested pattern doesn't work, you can discuss alternatives or try to compromise. And that's something that this particular employer didn't address at all. So the request was rejected, and of course the claimant appealed. And in her appeal, she suggested a compromise in that she would work 3 days in the office. Remember that she'd changed the formal request to wanting to work 3 days from home. So she'd compromised, I'll work 3 days in the office and two from home. And it got worse. So reading through the tribunal judgment, it records the reasons that the employer put forward when it rejected the appeal. But the problem was, is that these were not supported by the evidence. So one of the reasons they put forward was that in relation to her role, it was sort of logistics and dealing with shipping of products, etc. And one of the reasons they came up with was a shipping problem, which they said was due to problems caused by remote working. However, as anyone who has been in tribunal knows, it's a pretty forensic examination of the issue. So there's, you know, there's detailed evidence. If you've ever given witness evidence at a tribunal, it's really dug into very deeply. And as a result of this, it turned out that the evidence was that the respondent's problem with shipping actually turned out to have nothing to do with remote working, but was actually due to glitches in processes not working properly. There was a lack of clarity over responsibilities, which, of course, can happen whether you're working in the office or working remotely.
I think that, sorry to jump in again there, but
no, jump
that,
in.
that point is really important because
yeah,
it's really common for us to see situations where flexible working applications, flexible working requests have been looked at, but you can see that there are kind of assumptions already baked in in terms of how the scenario is positioned to us, for example. So the fact that, I mean, like you said, we know from all the litigation experience we've got about how forensically tribunals will go back and they'll look at emails from however many years ago, when they'll look at precise wording and they'll look at where the dots and the commas are and what the intent was. And there's a real actual risk, isn't there, that you're making decisions based on assumptions, and when they're actually stress tested properly, if you're on the unfortunate situation of litigating on this, you can come unstuck unless you can back up, what you're asserting there.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened at the tribunal. So some of the other business reasons were unpicked as well, and it all kind of unraveled. And basically, the tribunal agreed with exactly what you've just said, is that it had been approached with a closed mindset, which is, we're not going to allow it. Let's see what evidence we've got that can fit the factual matrix. Now, I think in this situation, the starting point is, OK, there's those eight statutory reasons. Let's see if our reasonings or our desire to reject the request fits into one of those. Then the next step is to, well, why does it fit into one of those? Why are we saying it? So, for those of you in HR and you're on the receiving end of this and you're looking to support a business in their approach on this, then I think that that's the stress testing role that you're going to be looking at. So if the business is putting forward the reasons, don't just accept it on face value if you're looking at rejecting a request. Let's just have a look at the evidence and see whether it stacks up, whether it does actually add up to one of those reasons. And I appreciate that most of you will do whatever you can to avoid going to tribunals, and quite rightly so. That's also the way that I operate. But at that particular point in time, we have to approach it from the end point, which is, at some point we could easily be giving evidence on oath with that evidence being before a tribunal. So let's start from that point, look backwards, and make sure that if we are making the decision, we're comfortable that the reasons we're putting forward do actually stack up. Just another part, just to throw in as a bit of an aside, and again, this is really common in the sort of the maternity returning situation, is that the emails that were before the tribunal, which probably didn't help in terms of where the tribunal's heads were at, was that the maternity cover was impressive. How many times have we heard that? Maternity cover turns out to be very good. The business would prefer to keep them. And this came out as a result of the disclosure process where, as you know, all parties have got to disclose everything that's relevant, whether it supports your case or not. So in this situation, the claimant had discovered that although she was told there was going to be an overlap to do a handover with maternity, in fact, what they'd done is they'd extended the maternity covers contract for a significantly longer period. I think it was about 5 or 6 months, may have been even longer than that, past the point when a handover will be done after the return to work. And of course, that in her mind was indicative that a decision had already been made. So that is that's tricky. You're going to jump in, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I can just envisage the tribunal kind of bristling as that evidence comes out, because even if it doesn't pose a particular legal, you know, pure legal issue, you just can't see it endearing the employer.
No.
They're going to go,
why did you do that? What was the purpose of keeping their contract going for that period of time? So it kind of puts you on the back foot. So, right. So how did she get on? Back to the case. Well, some of her flexible claims succeeded, such as the failure to deliver the outcome within the time frame. If you remember, flexible working requests used to have to be decided within 3 months. It's now down to 2 months. So it's quite a short period of time. These guys took significantly longer than that. So the tribunal found in their favour. But more importantly, because flexible working only gives a very small amount of compensation. But where the real teeth are, of course, is normally in indirect sex discrimination. And just as a reminder, the indirect sex discrimination claim is where you, as the employer, you put in place a provision, a criteria, or a practice which was known as a PCP. I always think it sounds like mouthwash, but that adversely impacts a group of people, putting them at a disadvantage, and that's a key point to remember. And the employee making the claim is in that group of people. Then the employer could justify what they do, but they have to show that that provision, criteria, or practice is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. And that is a right old mouthful. And, you know, it's probably the worst bit that people hate about lawyers is the fact that becomes so difficult. So let's just break it down a little bit. So we're putting in place a PCP. So in this case, it was the requirement that the employees work certain hours in person in the office. That was the provision that they applied across the workforce. Did it adversely impact a particular group of people? Yes, it adversely impacted. Working mothers was the group who had childcare responsibilities. Interestingly, in the tribunal, when I read it, they did say that they did make a nod of reference to changing social approaches on this. But they said, despite social changes, it is still women who primarily have the childcare responsibilities. But that's the first time I've seen it in a tribunal judgment. Then the final bit, is the employee in that group? Yes, she was a mother returning from maternity leave. Was she put at a disadvantage? And I said this was a key bit. And in this case, the disadvantage was actually to do with the refusal to let her make up the time in the evening. So that was the disadvantage that she suffered. It wasn't that it was... Put my teeth back in. The tribunal said that the disadvantage was her not being able to work her full hours because the company didn't allow her to make up the time in the evening. She then had to take a salary drop because her hours were reducing, and that was the disadvantage she suffered. So what was the legitimate aim that the business wanted to achieve by putting in place the PCP? They said meeting customer demand, maintaining quality and performance, all of which legitimate aims, absolutely. No issue with that whatsoever. But was the PCP, i.e. the requirement to work in the office the full hours, was that a proportionate means of achieving that aim? And that's where the flexibility is needed. And the tribunal basically said in rejecting the request, the employer was simply too inflexible. Some home or remote working and allowing her to make up time in the evenings would have been a more proportionate means of achieving that legitimate aim. And that was the decision on the sex discrimination, which gives rise to a much higher level of compensation than a breach of the flexible working request. So a really interesting claim in terms of how they map through everything set against this increasing mandate we're seeing about getting employees back to the office. So where does it leave us?
I've put the name of the case in the chat. So hopefully everyone has seen that if you want to Google around and find the government link and read it for yourself. Actually, before we get into where we are at the moment, we've had a couple of questions in. So let's just take a moment to look at those. So the first one is, How about since the pandemic was a long time ago? Some people have been recruited since and have never been in 5 days and performed fine. So why are 5 days required now? So I think this is making the point that if you've hired people post-pandemic for a
Remotely.
particular pattern, why, yeah, remotely, why do you suddenly need people back in the office?
Yeah.
And that's a good question. And yeah, I don't know.
That's
I don't.
exactly the question that a tribunal will ask.
Yeah, it
So it
is.
comes back
So,
round to you know, what's
what are your
changed?
reasons?
Yeah, what are your legitimate aims that have changed from when you recruited people? What areas of the business do you think are suffering as a result of remote working? What evidence have you got? What evidence have you got to support what your aims are? And what evidence have you got to show that having people back in the office is reasonable? Now, I mean, I think it's going to depend so much on the roles. So, for example, if you're in a creative industry and, typically you might be in that situation where you get heads around a table and you're bashing out ideas and you have all that need for that to be done. And there is perhaps that you've got some business data or anything that would support to say that it is far better to have that done in person. That would be the type of reason. But exactly the point that if you've hired people remotely and now you want to change, you're going to have to think about explaining why.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, someone was just asking for the case link, which I was just trying to find.
Okay.
I
Yeah.
can't get it quickly enough. Other question: if one of the reasons used to reject a request or a restructure reorganization, sorry, let me start again. If one of the reasons used to reject a request, so a flexible working request, I assume, is a restructure or a reorg, what does this actually look like? Example: company's gone through a merger and a team has doubled in size, but refused a flexible working request by a member of the team using the need to embed the new team into the business. The team are the same as equivalent levels of skills, knowledge, and capability.
So that's like trying to like build a sort of team morale, pulling people together, etc. I mean, I think in that situation, you'd have to be able to demonstrate that, that type of thing is e more easily done in person. So, a lot of our work now is done over email, it's done over Zoom calls, it's done over screen. So does the reality actually bear out what you're trying to do? I mean, obviously, my guilty pleasure, I'm going to admit this on a recorded meeting, but my guilty pleasure is doom scrolling through TikTok, and it is full of people going, "Oh, brilliant! I've traveled into work, and all I'm doing is sitting on my computer and on a screen all day." And it's all that type of stuff. So, is that the case? Is that the role? What does embedding the team together actually look like? Is it a situation where, in actual fact, referring back to this case and the need to have that flexible mindset, is it something where you might say, we can't do it right now, but is it something perhaps that we can look at in 3 months once we've embedded the team? So it's having that type of flexible mindset, I would suggest. I'm not saying it can't be done, not at all. And I mean, for example, we're back in the office. I like being in the office because we can talk to each other. So, but it's just making sure that you have got demonstrable evidence to back up your reasons.
Yes, although you're not in the office today, I
I'm
should
not today,
say.
no, but I am. Well,
So
that's because
black mark.
that is because you are.
That's because I am. We don't have Wi-Fi to fall over.
Yeah.
There's some more questions, but let's take those in a moment. So where does it leave us at the moment? Well, one thing I want to mention is one of my favourite topics currently, which is the Employment Rights Bill. We've done quite a few episodes just talking about the impact of that and what's coming down the line. There is a change here that impacts on flexible working requests specifically. If you want to hear us talking at length at that, just look back at some of the previous episodes we did before Christmas, where we did a deeper dive into the Employment Rights Bill. But one of the changes proposed in the current bill, so it's not law yet, but it's expected to come in within the next 18 months, is that an employer must state the ground for refusal of the request and explain why it's reasonable to refuse the request on those grounds. And it's the second part of that sentence which is going to be a bit more problematic for some employers because they need to go into more of the detail detail around why it's reasonable for them to hold a particular position. Now, our view is always the kind of enlightened employers amongst you, those that are kind of following best practice and doing things the right way, are going to be articulating clearly your reasons anyway. So there's probably not going to be too much change in terms of your own practice, but there'll be a lot of businesses out there that will get caught out, and there'll be an expectation on them to deliver more information when they're refusing those requests. If you're in the situation where you want to bring people back to the office, then you need to be aware of these types of issues arising. One thing we get asked a lot about is where employers stand generally with getting people back to work, so outside of flexible working requests. Mm-hmm. And the starting point always has to be what the contractual terms are between you and your employees. So what does the written contract of employment say? If there have been any home working arrangements brought in, has that been under a policy? Has it been under a contract variation? To what extent has the contract been varied to provide for permanent remote working? And what does it say about trying to undo those arrangements? Because, you know, one thing to think about is if you're in a scenario where those home working arrangements are now contractual, they've amounted to a variation to the contract. If you're looking to change that unilaterally, so not with consent of the individuals, it's very easy to trip into a collective redundancy consultation situation. And yes, you know, I do use the dreaded R word there, because if you look at the Trade Union Labour Relations Consolidation Act, all those rules in there, if you're familiar with it, Section 188, don't want to get too technical on this morning, but all of the collective consultation requirements can be engaged if you're trying to force through contractual changes. And be aware of the changes in the Employment Rights Bill as well in respect of dismissal and re-engagement exercises. So there's a big intersection of some chunky areas of law here and some potential big liabilities. That said, in terms of the practical stuff, getting people back to work, your employees are going to want to understand why. Why is it necessary? Your efforts in setting out the business reasons will not be wasted. So take the time to plan it out, stress test it, challenge the reasons, just make sure they stand up. Because if anybody litigates, yeah, that is what a tribunal is going to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to cover two things. One, it's going to be the platform where you are looking to get a consent to a change to the contract. It might also be as part of your comms where you don't need to change the contract because the contract says the place of work is the office, but you're giving that as an explanation. And also, if somebody then says, OK, fine, that's what it says in my contract, but now I'm going to make a flexible working request, all that evidence that you've used will also be in there so that that can drive your answers on the flexible working request. So it's critical to have that as your really good platform to start with.
Now, if you want to hear some extended episodes where we're looking at return to the office mandates as one episode, underperforming remote workers and how to manage that as another episode, and can you really work from anywhere, as in globally, answering that question, if you look at series 2, episodes 3, 4, and 5, so you can find them on Spotify. The videos of them will probably be on our website as well, npmlegal.co.uk. But certainly look out for those series 2, episodes 3, 4, and 5. If you want collaboration and ad hoc meetings, and that's part of your justification as to why you want people back, you've obviously got to set your office environment up to make that happen. Have those breakout areas, encourage people to come in and chat and mingle. You are going to be facing flexible working requests. So if all of a sudden you're sending out this mandate of we want people back, the flexible working requests are going to come rolling in. Of course, you know, one thing we know from the case we've been discussing this morning is approach those requests with an open mindset. You might face pushback from the business, but I guess you could say in terms of the sort of work that we're all involved in, it's risk management, isn't it? And what's the risk of saying no here? How do you assess that risk and how can you try and reach a resolution that works? Remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. And sometimes we encounter, you know, this thought process where it's very binary. It's either we accept the request that's made or we reject it. There is a third way, which is to try and compromise on something. And when you look into the judgment of what we've just been talking about, that's something that the tribunal were interested in. Was there any compromise? Was there any scope there? So you can compromise it. We've seen lots of situations where the initial request has been rejected, but a different way has been agreed on. It works for both sides. Think about using a trial period as well. I think they're often underused. So you can put a trial arrangement in place, just set the boundaries clearly. It's about clear communication. And the other key for that is monitor it. So don't just let it drift. See how it actually works in practice. If it doesn't, well, it's going to help you. You're going to have examples of why the arrangement hasn't worked, real life worked example in that scenario. If you come at this with a truly open mind, then you can look at tweaking the arrangements further as well. But just make sure that that trial period is supported and it's managed, and it'll all be good evidence. Of course, if the trial period does work and it's a success, in theory, there shouldn't be any issue in granting that application because it's been shown to actually work, and the trial period has proved that. Another
I just
thing,
wanted to,
yeah,
sorry, I
go
was
on. You're
just
going to
gonna,
jump
I,
in.
well,
Go.
I was only going to jump in to say, obviously, we've talked about working mothers bringing in direct sex discrimination cases, so that's kind of a big risk. And that doesn't have to be at the end of maternity leave. It can be at any time, in a flexible working request or anything else. But I think the bit that I wanted to add in was the sort of the commercial point, and this came up from a discussion with one of my clients this week. So you've got to think about your recruitment and retention strategy. So one of my clients said to me that it was a really good time to recruit for them because some of their biggest competitors were mandating everybody to go back into the office, which meant that people were leaving and looking for new jobs. So, if you are the business that has an open mindset, you are willing to support hybrid working, there is an opportunity potentially to pick up some good talent out there. Right, who are disgruntled with these changes, which they don't think. I mean, a lot of people are saying, I'm work my socks off when I'm at home. I don't agree that my performance is impacted, et cetera, et cetera. There may be people that don't do as much, but it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, and I'm off to find a better place. So, there is potential to use the hybrid working as a really good recruitment attraction tool.
Get that commercial edge on your competitors,
Yeah,
right?
yeah, yeah.
Shall we take just a few more of these questions before we wrap up today's session? Because I know we've had, as expected, we've had quite a few through. So, wouldn't the request to make up hours in the evening breach working time regs in terms of daily rest? Can an organization actually prove this as a formal pattern? Well, it's true that the working time regs do provide for periods of daily rest, but subject to those being complied with, I don't see a particular issue. I think the issue there is more about being able to track the hours, not the concept of being able to work in an unconventional way.
Yeah, I mean the rest periods under the working time regs are something that is not regulated by the Health and Safety Executive. It's something that's regulated by the employee bringing a claim. So I suppose practically speaking, if the employee has been allowed to make up their hours at the end of the evening and that works for them, the chances of them bringing a claim are unlikely. But of course, the daily rest period is probably still going to be sufficient, assuming that in this particular case they were using an hour of time to make up. So hopefully, it would be to the advantage of the employee, not the disadvantage.
Okay, and then we've operated a hybrid working policy 50-50 a month and now working towards 60-40 per week. What's good practice to give reasonable notice? We've got a core working hour policy in place from 11 till 7. We've recruited many recruits with a hybrid model offered as a benefit. When we've mentioned childcare costs need when we've mentioned childcare cost need and the response is hybrid working is not to support childcare needs. So when we've mentioned childcare costs, the response has been, I'm assuming the response from the business is the hybrid working is not there to support childcare needs. Well, first of all, to please my insurer, I'm going to say get some specific legal advice on it. And what we're talking about here is not specific legal advice, but with that disclaimer in place, I think you need to look at how long the arrangements have been in place for, what the communications were around when the arrangements were first rolled out, how long standing these arrangements are, and then it's a
Have you
particular
got
reasonable approach.
any have you got an option to flex it? Is it subject to review depending on the needs of the business? So, all of that good stuff. But in terms of, I think the question is sort of what's good practice to give reasonable notice. I think it's about talking to your employees and making sure that they're having that understanding that we've talked about. So you've looked at the contractual position, you've gathered your information as to why, and then you'll be looking to talk to the employees in order to take them on the journey with you so that they can understand the reason why. And in terms of reasonable notice, are you in a position contractually to impose it, or are you looking for the employees to agree? So there's kind of quite a lot to unpick there, hence Peter saying you probably need to get some
Yeah,
specific
I'm
advice.
not sitting on the fence by that, but that's quite a big project potentially. Someone else has commented, employees not interested in childcare once people back, so spent money on refurbishing the office. Well, maybe they've refurbished the office because they want people back. But yeah, I don't know whether what comes first in that scenario, but thank you for your comment. Karen says contract says base is in the office, but practice has been hybrid. Is it possible to say we're moving to 5 days back in the office? And if you don't want this, you must submit a flexible working request. In theory, yes.
Subject to everything we've
Subject
discussed
to everything
today.
we've said, I mean, we want to understand how that practice of being hybrids actually come about. Have there been any rules in place? What comms have gone out? I mean, that is quite important because you get into these disputes, and all of a sudden, the employee whips out an email that was sent 4 years ago saying, "Yeah, we're now going to let you work from wherever you want," and there's kind of no guardrails put around that. So, it's context specific, but reiterate, starting point is always what the contractual terms say. I appreciate figuring out what those contractual terms can be problematic. Not necessarily just what the pure original contract of employment says, because obviously they can get varied over time. But that is the starting point. So look at your contractual terms and build it out from there. This is an interesting one. What's your view on an attendance bonus to encourage those back to work 5 days a week? It's interesting in the sense that an employment lawyer says interesting could lead to litigation, could be problematic, could open up indirect sex discrimination risk. It kind of depends how the attendance bonus works, and you can just see the scope for some categories of employees being disadvantaged there. And you've got to figure out how you're going to accommodate people with disabilities who might need a reasonable adjustment, and let's say, working mothers, for example. In light of the case we've just been looking at, I don't know
Is
what
it a
you think about
proportionate means of you achieving your legitimate aim?
that.
Are there other ways in which you can achieve your legitimate aim? It may well be that it is a proportionate means and therefore you can justify it. So it depends on the circumstances.
Someone else has commented they've heard of people work turning up to the office, couldn't get a parking space, so went home, let alone a desk space. Yeah, I was reading an article in the Financial Times last week that was talking about that. I think it's JP Morgan. Don't
They
have
run
enough
out of desks, don't
space.
they?
They're looking at renting space from Credit Suisse. So yes, this is problematic for some companies. I think in the US, Amazon have faced challenges there as well. Culture and collaboration seem to be the reason, but there's an argument that culture and ways of collaboration have changed. Easy teams didn't exist. I agree. I think all of these decisions have got to be context specific for your particular organization, right? And even within organization at a team level, there are going to be some teams that could be really high functioning on a remote basis and some that aren't. I mean, you think about field sales teams, for an age, companies have operated field sales where people are permanently working away from the office because they're out visiting clients and customers and suppliers. And then last question, we were told by HR Inform, is that one of those services? Is that like an outsourced
I
HR
know.
service? I think it might be. We were told by HR Inform that we could only carry out flexible working trials within the 2 months from the submission of the request. You had said we can carry out trials if we set clear timelines. Is that within the 2 month period or can the trial be extended beyond? Oh, that's a good technical
Well, hang on a
question.
second. 2 months from the submission of the request, I think there's some confusion there. There is 2 months in which you have to hold the discussions and make the decision and communicate the decision on the outcome of the flexible working request. So I'm wondering if there's a bit of a mishmash there. So you've got to have meetings and consultations and decide, give the outcome and deal with any appeal all within a 2 month period from the date of the flexible working request. That's what the regulations say. If the outcome of your decision is we're going to trial it, say for 3 months, and as far as I'm aware, there's no statutory limit on a trial, but obviously if you go, we're going to trial it for 12 months, that's not particularly reasonable. So pick a time frame And trial it, a bit like a probationary period, I guess. Actually, I shouldn't have said that because that's all going to change too. But say you've got it, you're going to trial it over a 3 month period to see how it pans out, then potentially you can do it. There is some difficulty around whether it needs to be a permanent or a trial period on that basis. But I think a lot of companies do it nonetheless. And it shows a willingness to the tribunal in terms of, well, we're keeping an open mindset and this is how we wanted to support it. But I think there's a confusion over that 2 month period potentially.
Yeah,
I mean, there is a
I
bit in the law
think,
which says once you've agreed a request, it should be a permanent change, but I know many companies that do run it as a trial.
I think there's scope for a sensible discussion, isn't there? And
Yeah.
kind of agree with the individual what will happen in respect to their originating flexible working request, and
Yeah.
showing good willing and you're sensible about it, you're clear in terms of what you're documenting, then there's a way through to navigate that, isn't there? I
Yeah.
appreciate it gets harder maybe with massive employers with tens of thousands of employees and consistency of approach, but normally that's not the case. Let's wrap up. What's the postscript
Oh, yeah,
for the
just a really
case?
interesting one. Got absolutely nothing to do with returning to the office or flexible working, but I just wanted to come back to this case where the claimant's claim also included one for constructive dismissal. So, if you remember, constructive dismissal, the employee basically jumps, leaves the employment in response to a significant or repudiatory breach, is the legal term, of contract by the employer. So the key is that they have to jump quickly. Now, in this case, the claimant's evidence was that the breach was the refusal of the flexible working request, and that had actually happened before she returned to work. By returning to work and then resigning, the tribunal essentially said she was too late. She'd returned to work, she'd accepted the breach, and the constructive dismissal case failed. And I thought that was quite interesting because I think it was only about a period of about 6 weeks from
Interesting
the
one.
rejection. Yeah.
So I opened up the chat. I think that was my technical error before. So hopefully everyone can see the case. Bit of a mega session today. So thanks for sticking with us. Today was our fourth of 2025. So we've done a session already on what's in store for 2025 in terms of legislative change other than the Employment Rights Bill, you'd be pleased to hear. We did a session on 2P and changing contracts of employment and terms and conditions of employment post 2P. So look out for that one. And we also did a session on workplace harassment and what's going on at McDonald's. That was on most recent session 2 weeks ago. All of those are on Spotify. Just look for Employment Law 101. They're also on our website, npmlegal.co.uk. We'll be back 2 weeks' time at 11 o'clock to discuss another relevant case. If you've got any feedback for us in the meantime, we'd love to hear from you. So drop us a line. Otherwise, have a good rest of the week and we will see you in 2 weeks. But thanks for joining. Thanks for all your contributions and enjoy the rest of your week, everyone.